There's a Rashi right at the beginning of the Sedra. Moshe Rabbeinu tells Bnei Yisrael, Atem Nitzavim Hayom Kulchem Lefnei Hashem Elokeichem. You're all still standing before God. And the Medrash says the following background. Klal Yisrael heard 98 klolas in last week's Sedra. Aside from all the klolas they heard in Bechukosai, and they turned green. And they said, how could anyone possibly survive all of this? So Moshe Rabbeinu made them, pacified them. And he said to them, look, you angered God many times. You're still around, right? You haven't been destroyed. So don't let it bother you that much. What is Moshe Rabbeinu trying to do? God warns them with all these curses and all these terrible things. And Moshe says, don't take them seriously. Besides, that doesn't make sense. What do you mean? You sin many times, you're still around. Yeah, you sin many times. Thousands of people were killed. So what's Moshe Rabbeinu pacifying? What's he trying to tell them? He's trying to make little of what the Rabbanim are trying to make. I think the message that Moshe Rabbeinu is giving them is the following. If the Rabbanim Shalom is threatening to destroy you, then there's what to be really concerned about. But ultimately, the Rabbanim Shalom, when he punishes you, when he warns you, is not to destroy you. And that's what it says in the end of the Tochacha. V'afgam zos biyosam be'eretz oyveihem, in Bechukosai. Even when I send you into Golus, and you're in the land of your enemy, and you are subject to a lot of terrible things, lo ma'astim, it's not because I hate you. V'lo ga'altim, it's not because I'm disgusted with you. L'chalosam, it's not because I want to destroy you. L'hofer brisi itam, that I want to abrogate my covenant with you. Ki ani Hashem Elokeichem, I'm always your God. It's just that if you continue on the path that you were on, you'll destroy yourselves. You're going to commit spiritual suicide, like other nations did. The rise and fall of the Roman Empire, the Babylonians, the Persians. They all receded into history because God permitted them to commit spiritual suicide. But I don't want that to happen to you. I'm your God eternally. And therefore, I'm not going to let you destroy yourselves. So sometimes I'm going to have to do drastic things. And even some people, maybe even a lot of people, are going to have to leave this world. And that's what's necessary for their neshamas. That's what's necessary for Christ. It's like an operation. Sometimes you have to cut away, and sometimes even good flesh, together with the no good. But it's for the sake of the patient surviving, not because the doctor wants to hurt the patient, just the opposite. Wants him to survive. So therefore Moshe Rabbeinu said, Atem nitzavim hayom kulchem. You're still around. True. Many times you sinned, and many times you were punished, and terrible things happened. But it wasn't to destroy you. It was to make sure that you continue to exist. So therefore, there's no reason to feel abandoned, or that it's hopeless because of all these curses and warnings, because ultimately it's all for your good. It's all that in the end you should be able to survive. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu was telling them. That's the idea. And in fact, I think that's what it says in the end of Eicha. The second to the last pasuk in Eicha is Ki im ma'os ma'astanu katzafta aleinu ad ma'od. If you are really disgusted with us, you got angry too much with us. Which means the following. Rabbanu Shel Olam, if your intention was that you're disgusted with us, and therefore you want to get rid of us, then why take so long? Just get rid of us. The fact that your anger extended over 2,000 years in all different kinds of ways, obviously it's not that you want to get rid of us, just the opposite. It's Hashiveinu Hashem Eilecha v'nashuva. It's because you want us to return. That's the purpose. It's not a negative purpose. It's more like a therapeutic purpose. Okay, that's one idea. Any questions on that? Okay, then the Torah describes either, according to some opinions, the whole Torah or the mitzvah of tshuva. And it says that the Torah is not in the heavens. It's not on the other side of the sea. You don't have to go anywhere special to observe the Torah. You don't have to be an angel. You don't have to go up to the heavens to observe it. Ki karov hadavar ma'od b'ficho v'lvav chalasosa. Torah is very close to you. It's in your mouth and your heart to do. That's the way the Torah describes it. Mikarov hadavar ma'od b'ficho v'lvav chalasosa. Just as an aside, Torah is telling us that if you want to observe the Torah, you don't need anything that's superhuman. You don't have to go up to the heavens to do it. You don't have to go to across the sea to do it. It can be done anywhere. It's something that's possible for you to do. Okay. Before I was married, I lived in Miami. So I used to daven in the shul that eventually I became the rabbi of. And I remember there was a Sunday morning bar mitzvah. The shul had the policy, even in my time, but even before my time, that people who were basically not Shomer Shabbos, who wanted to have a bar mitzvah in the shul, couldn't have it on Shabbos, because it would involve too much Chil Shabbos. So they let them have either the bar mitzvah on Monday or Thursday, or if they were lucky that the bar mitzvah came around the Rosh Chodesh, then they had it on Rosh Chodesh. So these people obviously were very estranged from Yiddishkeit, but they wanted the kid to have a bar mitzvah. So they made the bar mitzvah on a Sunday morning Rosh Chodesh. That was like the ideal time. Okay, if you can't have it on Shabbos, at least Sunday morning Rosh Chodesh in America, that's, you know, Shabbos Sheni. It's not, right. So I remember I was learning in the back of the shul, learning Gemara. I must have been about 19, 20 years old. And the people that were there, you could see that they hadn't been in a shul either ever or in a long time. And there were people holding the Siddurim upside down, and they had English translation yet too, so something really was wrong. They didn't know what to stand, what to sit. They were like, you know, and then I get this feeling that I'm being watched. And I look up from the Gemara and I see this guy staring at me intently. So finally he gets enough courage up and he says to me, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm learning Talmud." He said, "Wow." He said, "I envy you." He said, "I'm 40 years old and I don't know the Hebrew alphabet. I don't know, to me that looks like Greek." He said, "I can't tell if it's upside down, right side up or whatever. And you're half my age, and you're reading this like you know, it's an ABC book. So I'm really envy you." So I wanted to make him feel good, and I said, "Look, it's never too late. Rabbi Akiva was 40 years old also, and he also didn't know how to learn Torah, and he became one of the greatest sages in Israel." The guy thinks for a few minutes, and he looks at me, and says, "Rabbi, yeah, but Europe was different." Europe was different. Okay, Rabbi Akiva became great because he lived in Europe. So that's what it says over here. The Torah is not Me'ever L'Yam. It's not Europe. It's not here. You want to learn, you can learn. You don't have to be in this place or that place or whatever. I always like to say that that's what it says. When we came to Midbar Sinai, so the Torah says, "B'chodesh hashlishi letzeis b'nei Yisrael mi'aretz Mitzrayim b'yom hazeh bol midbar Sinai." Next pasuk says, "V'yisu mirefidim v'yavo midbar Sinai." So the Gemara says it's redundant. I knew they were in Refidim before this. Torah says where they came from. It says they came to midbar Sinai. They must have left Refidim. You can't be in two places at the same time. So it's obvious that they left Refidim and came to midbar Sinai. Why did the Torah have to redundantly say, repeat it, that Yisum Refidim, they left Refidim and they came to Midbar Sinai? So Rashi says, one of the lessons is to tell me that just as when they came to Midbar Sinai, they had done tshuva, right? Because in Refidim they sinned, Rafu Yudeim and Atorah, that's when Amalek got them. So too, before they left Refidim, they also did tshuva. So that means the tshuva wasn't when they came to Midbar Sinai, it already was when they left Refidim. Who cares? Once you do tshuva, it helps retroactively. So why do I really care if they did tshuva when they left Refidim or they did tshuva when they came to Midbar Sinai? Either way, it affected the same thing. Why did the Torah feel it necessary to tell me they did tshuva when they left Rafidim? I think the lesson is the following. It's a very important lesson. Many people say, I would like to improve. I'd like to change. But I can't under the circumstances that exist now. As soon as my circumstances change, then I will also be able to change. But right now, where I am and where I live and my marital status or my, the status with my parents, whatever it may be, prevents me from making any significant changes in life. But as soon as the conditions change, then I'll change. Person's fooling himself. The change depends on you. And if you can't do it now, you won't do it later either. That doesn't mean that you can always deal with every situation the same way. But it means that at least in some way, a person can change, can begin a change in whatever situation he's in. And if he always is waiting for a situation to change, it's never going to happen. It's never going to be ideal. And if you're always looking for the ideal situation, and then I'll improve, then I'll do tshuva, forget it. You're never going to do it. You're fooling yourself. If they couldn't do tshuva in Rafidim, which was not an ideal place, because that's the place where they sin, then they wouldn't have done tshuva in Midbar Sinai either. That's what the Torah is telling us. They had to be able at least to start the tshuva in Rafidim. Because if they couldn't, and they blamed the place, and they need a new place, it never would have happened. Okay, so therefore the Torah says, Lo bashamayim hi. You don't have to go up to the heavens to keep the Torah. You don't have to be an angel to keep the Torah. Torah is observable by human beings. And if it wouldn't be something that a human being can do, God wouldn't demand it from us. Those things that the Torah says are beyond human capability. For instance, the case of Eishes Yifas Torah, I think I told you this a few weeks ago. Rabbi Cheskel Avramsky's Rebbetzin made this point. She said the Torah knew that a man in a wartime situation who's enamored with this goyish woman, if the Torah would not have permitted it after a certain process, he couldn't have held himself back. He couldn't have controlled himself, and he would have done it in a prohibited way, and therefore the Torah permitted it. What does that mean? That God who created us knew that under these circumstances, psychologically, the person couldn't have controlled himself. Therefore, God didn't prohibit it. He permitted it with certain guidelines. That means that wherever God did prohibit something, it's possible for a person to do it. Not that a person should say, look, Lashon Hara, that's an ideal, but it's humanly impossible not to speak Lashon Hara. You have to be an angel. No, it's humanly possible, because if it wouldn't be, the Torah wouldn't demand it. The Torah, God created us, he knows what we're capable of doing, and he only prohibits what we can do. And makes us do what we can do, not what we can't do. So lo bashamayim hi, the Torah is not up there in the heavens. We learn from that no Navi can come to give you new mitzvahs. You don't need new mitzvahs. The same old Torah is applicable to all times and to all people. You don't need something new to be able to adapt. And it's not somewhere else. It's not Europe. It's not over there where you can keep the Torah. Anywhere where you are, the mitzvahs that apply in that place, you can keep. So it's korov eidecha me'ol b'ficha. You need it in your mouth, in your heart, la'asoso, to do. Now, it would seem like the order is not proper. Because your mouth is verbal, your heart is thought, and lasoso is action. Now, if I had to put those into an order, I would have one of two possibilities. Either thought, speech, action, going from the more spiritual to the more physical. Thought is more spiritual than speech. And speech is more spiritual than action, and action is the most physical. Or the opposite. Action, speech, thought. But why is it speech, thought, action? Doesn't seem to be the right order. The answer, I think, is that the way that a person functions is really with four levels. The first level doesn't even count. The first level is you get this idea, brainstorm. like in the comic books, the light bulb lights up above your head. Right? It's an idea that you really can't quantify. You didn't yet think it out, and it's a lightning bolt hits, and you get this idea. In order to make the idea a real idea, you first have to verbalize it, speak it out. Then it becomes a real thought. Through the speech, you crystallize the thought. So first, that first blitz doesn't count, because it doesn't come to anything unless you put it into some kind of framework. So the first thing is verbalize the lightning bolts that you have, you know, that give you a hashra'ah, right? What is it called in English?
Inspiration.
What? Inspiration, right? That inspiration, right? Verbalize the inspiration, make it something real. Then you have now a thought, and from that thought you can have action. That's how it works. So that's b'ficha, then bilvavcha, and then lasoso. If you think about it, that is the order of the yamim tovim. Pesach is b'ficha, right? And it also fits something else. Chachma, bina, das. Chachma is factual knowledge. Chachma is you possess a lot of facts. Chachma is the ability to integrate information, analyze it, and come to a conclusion of what is true and what is not true. You build a database. That's called Chachma. Bina starts where Chachma ends. Once you have the base of data, of facts, what do you do with it? What are their implications? How do you build on them? What do you understand from those facts? Right? That's called Bina. Bina is bone. You build. Mevin dover mitoch dover. From the facts that you have, you understand their implications. You understand what you can derive from them. That's called Bina.
The integration of the
data of the knowledge. And Das means that now you put it into practice. You take the information and the understanding of the implication, the integration, and you apply it to real life. You put it into practice. Das comes from the Lashon of Kesher, Hiskashrus, right? Das is used for intimate knowledge. Vayedach Adam Eschava Ishto is a chibur, is an attachment. They became attached. And that is Das. Das is to take the abstract knowledge and put it into practice, attach it to the real world. That's Das. You think about it, so that's the order. Chachma, first you verbalize the facts, then you think about them, and you integrate them, you assimilate them in and build on them and understand their implications, and then you put them into practice. If you think about it, that is the Yomim Tovim. How do they work? Pesach is Chochma, knowledge. What do we do on Pesach? We come to the realization there's a God. How do I know? He took me out of Egypt. He did all these miracles, 10 plagues, split the Red Sea. Right? So all these facts are there for me to be impressed with the fact that the fact is that there's a God. There's a fact. Pesach establishes facts. Therefore, we ask questions, we give answers. And who's the star of the Seder? The Chacham. Chachma. Pesach is Chachma. And therefore, it's mostly a function of your mouth. Pesach, a mouth that speaks. And what do we do on Pesach? Use our mouth. Either we're talking or we're eating. One of the two. Either it's coming out or going in. Right? That's Pesach. That's it. Nothing else. Right? Your mouth. So Pesach is beficha. Then comes Shavuos. Shavuos, there's nothing to say from the Torah, right? There's no stories, no nothing. There's nothing to do. There's no special mitzvahs. It's all in your heart. What is Shavuos? Kabbalah Satorah. Okay, now that I know there's a God, so what? That should bring me
to now accept his kingdom and to keep his mitzvahs and to accept the Torah. That's all in your heart. That's Bina. Shavuos is Kabbalah HaTorah, which is Bina. And I'll prove to you that the capacity to accept mitzvahs is a function of Bina. Because the Gemara says that women become liable to mitzvahs a year before their male counterparts. A woman is bas mitzvah at 12 and a boy at 13. Says the Gemara, why? Because Bina Yisera Nitna Be'isha Yosef Be'ish. A woman was given extra Bina, more than a man. What is Bina again? A woman has an extra capacity for integrating knowledge and understanding what its implications are. A man's role in Torah is to learn Torah, to assimilate facts, to analyze facts. That's learning Gemara. A woman doesn't have to do that. But the man brings home the halachas, the facts to the woman, and she then creates a framework called a bias. The bias is the beis, is the bina. She understands the implication of those facts and creates an environment which is conducive to living those facts. That's bina. And together, the husband and wife actually put it into practice. That's das. So women become bas mitzvah a year early because they have greater bina. That means bina is the capacity for accepting mitzvahs. So Shavuos, which is Kabbalah HaTorah, it's not verbal, it's not action, it's thought. And that's Bina. And lastly comes Sukkos. Sukkos is Das. Leman Yedu Doroseichem. Right? That's Sukkos. Das. And therefore, you have all these mitzvahs that are concrete, physical mitzvahs. The sukkah, the esrog, and the lulav, and all the sacrifices, and the pouring of the water on the mizbeach. There's so many mitzvahs maisios on sukkahs. Sukkahs is the untif of das, of taking the knowledge that you got on Pesach, the understanding of that knowledge that you got on Shavuos, put it into practice. Now, let's take it one step further, because we're not holding by yet by Sukkos, surely not by Pesach and Shavuos. We're more Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. How do they fit in? So this would be perfect had there not been a sin of the golden calf. You have to build up. First you need the Chochma, you need Pesach. Without that, you can't get to Shavuos, which is the Bina. Without the Chochma and the Bina, you can't get to Sukkos. Okay. So we got the Chochma on Pesach. We got the Bina on Sukkos, the Beficha of Vilvavcha, and then we were ready right away for Sukkos. I mean, the Bina on Shavuos, now we're ready for Sukkos. What happened? Right away we sinned with the golden calf. So we, to a certain degree, negated the Chochma we got on Pesach and the Bina that we got on Shavuos. So first we had to restore it before we could get Sukkos. Therefore, Sukkos was delayed. It really should have come right after Shavuos. That's when we were in the desert, in the sukkahs. But it had to be delayed because we abrogated the Chochmah and the Bina. You can't get the Das unless you have that first. Therefore, God added two more Yamim Tovim to bolster what was blemished by Pesach and what was blemished by Shavuos. The holiday that bolsters Pesach is Rosh Hashanah. How so? Rosh Hashanah is very similar to Pesach. Why? Because the major thing we use on Rosh Hashanah is our mouth. What is the hallmark of Rosh Hashanah? Blowing the shofar and the extra davening. Malchios, Zichronos, and Shofros, which is all speech. Speech or using your mouth. And the shofar is called Chochmah. Rosh Hashanah, we get back the information that we lost because of the sin of the golden calf that we got on Pesach. What is the information? That there's a God. How do I know? He took me out of Egypt. So, making that declaration, Malchios, I recognize God's kingdom. Zichronos, I recognize that he has divine providence. Shofros, I recognize the fact that he revealed himself to us at Matan Torah and other times in history. That's the facts of God's existence. That bolsters what was blemished from Pesach. Rosh Hashanah takes that place. It doesn't take the place, but it bolsters it. Yom Kippur is when we got the second Luchos. What we got on Shavuos was broken. When do we get it back? On Yom Kippur. So Yom Kippur bolsters Shavuos. It's the remedy for Shavuos that was destroyed when we did the Chet HaEgel. Yom Kippur, again, there's not too much verbal. It's basically tshuva in your heart, that you regret the sins and you commit yourself not to do it. The major part of tshuva is in your heart. So Yom Kippur is not action. It's not verbal. It's what's in the heart. Understand the implications. Okay, if I understand, there's a God and he has divine providence and he's revealed himself, then put it all together. I better do what he says. So that's tshuva. That's Kabbalah Satorah. That's just like Shavuos. Once you have the strength of what Pesach, Chochmah, which is bolstered by Rosh Hashanah, and you have the Bilvavcha in your heart, the Bina, which is Shavuos, which is bolstered by Yom Kippur, now you can have Sukkos. That's why Sukkos comes after Yom Kippur. It really should have come after Shavuos, but it was impossible because we abrogated Pesach and Shavuos to a certain degree, so we needed something to bolster it. So the Rambam gave us Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and then comes Sukkos. Okay, and it follows that Beficho Vilvav Chalasosa. Okay. It says that the Torah is Korov Ma'od. It's very close to you. Okay? Korov Ma'od. So really, it should have said it's Ma'od Korov. Right? Not Ki Korov Hadover Ma'od Beficho Vav Chalasosa. It should have said Ki Ma'od Korov Hadover. Why does it say Ki Korov Hadover Ma'od? So I think maybe it hints to something that the Kotzker Rebbe says on the following Medrash. The Medrash says there was once a man who was a total ignoramus. He didn't even know Aleph Beis. And he wasn't humbled by it, but he was bragging, and he was making fun of Eliyahu Navi. So Eliyahu said to him, "Look, it doesn't bother me that you're making fun of me. You know what bothers me? You are a total ignoramus. You don't even know Aleph Beis. After 120 years, you're going to go to the heavenly court. The first question they're going to ask you is, did you learn Torah? You don't even know what an Aleph is. Aren't you scared?" He said, "No. I have an answer rehearsed. And when they hear my answer, God's going to have to admit that it's right. And they're going to usher me right away into Gan Eden." So Eliyahu said, "I'm curious. Let's play Beis Din Shamala. I'll be the Beis Din, you be you. Let's hear your answer." So Eliyahu says, "How come you didn't learn anything?" He says, "Because I'm stupid. God created me with a low IQ, and therefore I couldn't learn. It's not my fault. It's God's fault. And it's really true. I am stupid." So Eliyahu says, "Sounds like a good answer, but let me ask you one question. What do you do for a living?" He said, "I'm a fisherman." He said, "Could you describe for me what you have to know to be a successful fisherman?" He says, "Well, first you have to know how to make a net. So we plant flax. We let it grow, we take it, we comb it, we make ropes out of it, we make nets. A net is not such a simple thing to make. You have to make the holes not too big, not too small, otherwise the fish will get out of it or they'll see the nets. So you have to make it just right. Then you have to put it into the river, the lake, right, the stream, not too deep, not too shallow, in the right kind of place. We have simonim, where the fish are and how deep or whatever. We catch the fish, we clean them, we sell them, that's how I make a living." Eliyahu says, "Interesting. For fishing, God gave you brains. And for Torah, which it says, Ki Korov Hadover Ma'od, Beficho Vilvav Chalasoso, it's very close to you. For that, God didn't give you brains. How could it be?" And the guy starts to cry, and he realizes that his excuse is no excuse, because he does have brains. Says the Kotzker Rebbe, "What was the fact? Was the guy dumb or not? If he was really dumb, how did he learn how to fish? And if he wasn't really dumb, how did he fool himself into thinking that he was?" That's the Kotzker Rebbe's question. Says the Kotzker Rebbe, the guy was really dumb. He really could not learn Torah. He was right. He learned to fish. You know why he learned to fish? Because he knew that if he didn't learn to fish, he'd die of starvation. And sometimes when something is do or die, even if you're not capable of doing it, you do it. People have been known in earthquakes to lift walls that weigh hundreds of pounds off of them, because they knew that if they remained under the wall, they'd suffocate. People have been known to run over by trucks to pick up the truck and get out from under the car. It happens. The adrenaline, the knowledge that it's either do or die, you go beyond your capabilities. It happens. Had the guy thought about Torah, that it's my life, I can't live without it, he would have learned Torah too. That's what it says. Ki karov hadover. When is it close to you? Me'od, when you want it a lot. Then it's beficho v'lovcha asoso. But if it's not karov elecha, me'od, you don't really want it, then Torah also something that you may not be able to do. Okay. Next. It's a very interesting Rashi. It says that Moshe Rabbeinu, God told him to take Yoshua. They're now going to, he's going to induct Yoshua to be the coming leaders the day that he died. And he was told to take Yoshua and to go to Ohel Moed, to go to the Mishkan. God has something to say to him. So they're both standing outside the Ohel Moed, and the voice comes out, Yoshua, come in. Nope. Yoshua goes alone. Moshe's standing outside. Yoshua goes in. And Yoshua comes out, and Moshe says, no, what did God tell you? He said, did you ever tell me what God told you? Right? When he told you privately? Right? So Moshe Rabbeinu said, I can't take this anymore, Rabbanu Shalom. It's time for me to leave this world. Right? This is not... Already he said, you know, I can't live like this. So Yoshua was punished for that. That they forgot 300 halachas the day that Moshe Rabbeinu died. Now, why did Yoshua do such a thing to hurt Moshe Rabbeinu? This is his favorite student. This is his Rebbe. How can you do something like that to your Rebbe? Now, the answer is, Yoshua saw that this was God's intention. Why? What was he doing to Moshe Rabbeinu? Moshe Rabbeinu, what's it called? Nistumu mimenu mayonos hachachman, says that day he began to forget things. Even though Moshe Rabbeinu was perfectly, the perfect physical specimen. But obviously God was making it easy for him to leave the world. It's one of the reasons why people become old and they have all these krankheit and they have, they start forgetting. And because God's doing them a chesed. If people would be in their prime and have to leave this world, nobody wants to leave this world. But if you're already, I can't eat, I don't have any teeth, I can't hear, I can't see, I can't remember anything, right? So you feel like, you know, it's no big deal. So it makes it easier to leave this world. So the Rabbanu Shem does a chesed to many people that he makes it easier for them to leave the world, especially people die of old age, makes it easier for them to leave the world. So Yoshua saw that that's what God's doing to Moshe. So he said, I'm going to jump on the bandwagon. I'm going to make him feel terrible too. So he'll also say, you know what, no, not so terrible leaving. Let me get out of here already. It's time for me to go. So then why was Yoshua punished? He did it l'shem shamayim. We find a similar thing by Penina and Chana. Chana had no children, and Penina had 7 children. And Chana wanted a child, and she davened. And Penina used to taunt her, and she used to buy clothing for her children, and she would show it to Chana and say, what do you think about this for this child or that child? And if you had a child, would you like this clothing? And mamash like was daggers in her heart. The poor woman didn't have any children, and this her sister wife is taunting her. So the Gemara says Penina and the Satan were mechaven l'shem shamay, but they both get punished in the end. And Penina got punished that she lost all her children. Menchane had children. So why was she punished? Why did she do this? She didn't do it to hurt Chana. She did it because she wanted Chana to daven and cry with all her heart. And she figured this is going to make her cry with all her heart. And because of that, Chana was answered. So Penina did her a favor. She meant it l'shem shamayim. Then why was she punished? The answer is, you don't hurt people even l'shem shamayim. You don't make people feel terrible with the intention that some good's going to come out of it. Good should come from good, not from making people feel terrible. Now, God did it. Why can God do it and people can't do it? So I was thinking, because the Rabbanu Shalom is beyond time. So if God makes someone feel bad now, but there's a future benefit, right? By God, it's all the same thing. The past, the present, the future is all the same thing. So I'm not really hurting you now and later it'll be good. It's all one package. By God, it's possible. But by a human being who is limited by time, if you make somebody hurt now in the present and the good won't come till later, right now they're hurting. Right now it's something bad. It's something bad for the sake of something good in the future that you can't do. The end doesn't justify the means. Do the right way. Don't hurt somebody in order to give them a benefit, because for you, you're limited by time. This right now is bad. The future may be good, but you have to deal with as it is now. God, there's no past, present, and future. So at the same time that he's making Moshe feel bad, he already sees the Olam Haba from it. That's the idea. One last thing. It says that Hakel, Mitzvah Hakel, the end of Shemitah, the first night of Chol HaMoed Sukkos, they built a big bima in the Azara, and the Melech would get on top, and he would read Sefer Devarim and some other parts of the Torah to the Jewish people. And everybody had to come. Men, women, children, even infants. So the Gemara asks, I understand men come to learn and women come to listen and children come to be educated. Why do you bring infants? What in the world are the infants going to gain from Hakel? So the Gemara says, Litein Sachar Limavi'ehem. It's to give reward to the people who bring them. That's the purpose of bringing the infants. Now, some learn that that means that there is a benefit to bring the infants. Like it says that Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya, his mother used to bring his crib into the Beis Medrash so he would absorb the Torah learning and it had an effect on him. It's the same thing over here. You bring them to this occasion and they absorb it by osmosis. Okay, but it doesn't say that in the Gemara. The Gemara should have said then, you bring them so they should absorb the environment. It says to give reward to the people who bring them. Says the Shurei Das, it tells the Rosh Hashiva, we mentioned that there are two benefits to mitzvahs and two detriments to averas. One is the king and the other one is the doctor. You get rewarded because you obeyed God. God will reward you for doing a mitzvah. And he'll punish you for doing an avera because you rebelled against him. Also, the mitzvah and the avera are also beneficial intrinsically. If you do the mitzvah, it's like a vitamin. If you do the avera, it's like a poison. So every mitzvah has two benefits. The reward because you listen to the king, and the reward that is intrinsic to the mitzvah itself. Every avera has two detriments. You rebelled against the king, so he'll punish you, and the avera is like a poison. It's gonna harm you. He says, but there are certain mitzvahs that are exceptions. One is Eishes Yifas Tohar. The Torah said it's rotten. If you marry this woman, you're probably going to end up having a ben soru mori, you're not going to like her, whatever. It's not a good thing. It's rotten meat. But the Torah permitted it. Meaning, the king is not going to punish you as a king. But he's warning you as a doctor, it's still not healthy. So here, the detriment of the Avera is there, but the rebellion against the king isn't, because the king says, I'm looking the other way, I'm not going to prohibit it. Because I know it's hard for you to do. Hakel is the opposite. There is no intrinsic value to bringing an infant to Hakel. None at all. So why did God make you bring them? Because there's no other Eitzah. Everybody has to come. Even the kids are like, who's going to be the babysitters? Leave an Arab? Who are you going to leave the kids with? Right? So everybody is going to be at Hakel. Everybody. So you're going to have to bring the infants by necessity. So God said, you're going to have to bring them anyway. I'm going to make it a mitzvah to bring them. And if you have intention to fulfill my command, I'll give you a reward. So this, there's no intrinsic value to doing it, but there's a reward from the king. This is also an exception, where only one aspect of the mitzvah applies, not the other aspect.